Scientists studying glaciers are learning more about how the Earth's remote ecosystems have been influenced by the Industrial Revolution. Research conducted in Alaska is providing evidence of fossil fuels in glacial ice. The research was published in the March issue of Nature Geoscience. Joining us to talk about it is Robert Spencer, assistant scientist at the Woods Hole Research Center. Welcome to the program.
Hi, and thank you for having me.
So glaciers, like sediment, can give us a glimpse into our past.
Yes, they can. And I mean, a lot of my colleagues are working on glacial cores, which are very similar to sediment cores. How our research sort of differs is we're looking at depositional processes onto the surface of the glacier, and we're seeing that material move through the glaciers and be exported in the meltwaters. And so, if you like, we're getting the meltwaters are an integrator of all the processes that are going on in these systems. The glaciers we're looking at in the Gulf of Alaska, particularly one we've been focusing on a lot just outside Juneau, it takes about 300 years for the ice from deposition to melt out of the terminus of the glacier for it to move through the system. But yet the age of the carbon that's coming out, we're finding, is somewhere on the range of 4,000 to 5,000 years old. And so we know we're getting deposition of much older material. It's not just the time it takes for that material to move through the glacial system.
So does that mean you're getting the older material and some of the newer together then? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and so it's one of those things where we're dating the organic carbon in these systems via radiocarbon dating. And so there you're looking at the bulk age of this material. And so you could have some very, very old radiocarbon dead material, like fossil fuel material, which is what we have in these systems, and some modern material put in as well. And so it gives you the average age right. That's in that system.
Oh, interesting. So we're seeing glacial ice loss accelerating and driven in part by carbon in the form of soot or black carbon. So what is this black carbon?
Well, as you said, black carbon is often called soot. It's an incomplete combustion product derived from burning of fossil fuels, biofuels, and open biomass burning. So if you think wildfires, slash and burn agriculture. And black carbon is deposited in the surfaces of snow and ice. It enhances solar radiation absorption and thus reduces the albedo and accelerates melting in glacial systems. Black carbon also warms the Earth directly by absorbing energy when suspended in the atmosphere. And so there's really two ways it increases glacial melting.
So this black carbon, it's laying on top of the surface of the glaciers then? And then, so do we see it? Is it visible to the eye or not?
Not in the places where we're working. And I mean, it's also difficult to tell because there's so much like rock debris and all the things on the surface of these glaciers. But certainly if you go to other parts of the world, Tibet, people say you can see it on the surface of glaciers. And at the large scale, if you think the volcanoes that erupt, I mean, there was the one in Iceland a few years ago, and you see the ash on the surface of the glaciers, and people can go and find these ash deposits. And so there are times when you can see it. But on the whole, it's just coming down with the precipitation, with the snow as it comes onto the surface of the glaciers.
Okay. So how far into the glaciers do we find black carbon, or do we know? I mean, it's just, you're just working on the surface, right?
Yeah, so we're working on the surface, and we're working on the meltwaters that are coming out of these glacial systems. And so for our work, we're finding it in the meltwaters at the same extent that we're finding it on the surface. And so if you assume the meltwater is an integrator of what's going on through the system, it's, you know, in the glaciers in Alaska that are sort of 300-400 years old, it's pretty ubiquitous throughout that glacial system. However, colleagues who've been working on other glaciers where you have much deeper, or you can do very deep ice cores, they find a step, if you like, about 100, 150 years ago, where you see an increase in deposition of black carbon around the time of the Industrial Revolution.
That's interesting. So this black carbon that gets into the meltwaters, which kind of runs into the rivers and the ocean, does it cause damage? I mean, what's the negative side of that?
Well, that's sort of where we got into this. We were initially looking at how the Gulf of Alaska would change with glaciers as they declined in that region. And so the Gulf of Alaska is a great place to work for doing a space for time transition, because you've got lots of small watersheds that range from wetland-dominated, sort of rain-dominated systems to snow-dominated systems to then the glacial systems. And you can do a space for time comparison where you would move from, if you like, the glacial systems through to the wetland systems. And you move from a very sort of pulse in meltwaters, if you like, in the glacial systems in the summer to rainfall dominated, very individual event driven pulsy system. And so we were interested in how that changed export of organic carbon nutrients to the coastal ocean and potential ramifications for fisheries and these sorts of things downstream. when we started looking at this, what we found more and more was that the material coming out of the glacial systems was very biologically labile. And so this carbon at the base of the food web, if you like, that the heterotrophic bacteria chew on, is providing a big energy subsidy coming from glacial ecosystems. And we were surprised by this because you don't, you know, you think of glaciers as a big block of ice.
Right.
You don't really think of them as a source of anything. Mm. And so that led us to this question of, well, where's this organic carbon coming from? Because it's highly biologically labile and is providing this energy subsidy at the base of the food web. And if you think about, you know, the Gulf of Alaska, it's a highly productive system.
This research that was done near Juneau, Alaska, you don't think of that as a being a very industrial area, yet we're finding a lot of this black carbon. So this is obviously coming from other areas of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's really where our ongoing work is now. It's assessing the sources of this material and where it's coming from. I mean, in Juneau, it's coming predominantly across the Pacific from Southeast Asia, so China, India. And that's where we believe the source of the black carbon we're seeing is in southeastern Alaska.
So, are there any benefits to this black carbon? I mean, is there a good side to it, or is it?
Well, I mean, one of the interesting things that we've sort of come across with this work is it's almost you're adding extra carbon into the system, but it, if you like, you're adding black carbon's coming from these fossil fuel combustion sources, and predominantly in our case, and so it's akin to, if you like, humans using fossil fuel sources to subsidize our energy needs. And so I don't really think that's a great thing to be doing at the base of the food web, because we don't know how it's going to play out. And black carbon as a whole is, as I said, I think I mentioned the issues with increased glacial melting and climate change, but it also has issues with respect to human health. It's estimated that somewhere around the 1.5-2 million people mark in developing countries die every year from respiratory diseases due to exposure to black carbon and other emissions from incomplete combustion. And so it's not really...
So this is a bad... This is
a bad
negative.
Thing.
This is a bad thing. There's nothing good about it. So reducing that black carbon would be... Obviously, there'd be benefits to doing that sooner rather than later.
Yeah. And I mean, we, as the developed nations, have reduced in many cases our emissions by a factor of 5 or more since the 1950s by moving to cleaner technologies. And obviously we've still got a long way to go. But I mean, just trying to get developing nations to take on board some of those cleaner technologies, especially coal fire power plants, they're obviously a big source of black carbon. I mean, you can go to a lot of Western Europe and you see the black on the old buildings and stuff. And so if we can get new developing countries to use new technologies, cleaner technologies, and ourselves, we have to continue down that road to reduce black carbon emissions. But one of the good things about black carbon is it remains in the atmosphere for only on the order of, say, several weeks or so, as opposed to carbon dioxide, which will still be trapped in the atmosphere 100 years from now. And so reducing black carbon emissions is one of the quickest ways to significantly reduce global climate change.
That's interesting. We're talking with Robert Spencer, assistant scientist at the Woods Hole Research Center. We're talking about his research on black carbon in glaciers. So this dissolved organic matter that's found in the ice. So when it melts, the carbon flows downstream. And it was believed that this dissolved organic matter, which you call DOM, was coming from ancient forests and peatlands that were overrun by the glaciers. But this research is showing, well, maybe not.
Yeah, so about 3 years ago, when we started looking at this organic carbon in the glaciers in southeast Alaska, when we dated it, we were coming out with an age around 4,000 or 5,000 years before present. So we assumed initially that that matched up with the hypsothermal warm period. And at that time, something we don't think about too much today was glaciers advancing. And they overran the forests and the wetlands that were down the mountainsides beneath them. And you can go to some of these glaciers and you can see trees frozen in the bottom of these systems. And so we thought that that might be the source of organic carbon coming out of those glacial systems. The work that we then carried on to do, we're still getting the same radiocarbon ages, but obviously you can get to that bulk age via a number of different mechanisms, especially if you have radiocarbon dead material in there, like coming from fossil fuels. We used an approach looking at biomarkers. So lignin is a tracer for hyovascular plants. You say, for example, algae and microbes don't produce lignin. And so we found a very small contribution of lignin to the total carbon coming out of these systems. So that would sort of rule out trees as the source of that material. So we used a relatively new technique, ultra-high resolution mass spectrometry technique, which is kind of akin to a molecular fingerprinting of organic matter. This technique allows the assignment of exact molecular weights and formula to thousands of individual molecules. And so if you like, the complex soup of natural organic mixtures can be broken down to its individual ingredients. So when we did this, we were looking for those ingredients, if you like, that can then tell us about the origin of this organic matter. And so in the glacier systems, we see lots of condensed aromatics, and we know that they're only formed through heating of organic matter. And so they indicate the presence of combustion. Mm. And the glacier samples also contain a high abundance of aliphatic compounds, especially fatty acids, with long chain lengths reaching 30 plus carbons. And we know from previous studies that this sort of material is also associated with soot, and it's also very biodegradable, and so it sort of matches what we're finding in the meltwaters.
That's fascinating that way technology is you know, growing in leaps and bounds, that we're able to determine these things that we weren't able to determine. So there's no doubt that this carbon is from fossil fuels then.
It seems it's looking that way, and I mean, that's kind of, so as we move forward with this now, if you like, we've been working on one region in the Gulf of Alaska predominantly. And there's two ways that we can sort of prove our hypothesis correct that this is coming from fossil fuel combustion byproducts. And one of them is to look at other glaciers around the globe. And that's something we're starting to do now and see. Mm-hmm. I mean, if it's a depositional process, it should be global to some extent. And then the other one is to go back through ice cores, and it should decline at depth once you get past the Industrial Revolution.
Right. So there's still a lot of work to be done, obviously, in this area. So how much do we know about the ecosystems of glaciers and ice sheets?
Not very much. I mean, there's two challenges with working as a biogeochemist in those systems. One, I mean, there's this historic view that they were almost somewhat devoid of life, and there's not a lot going on there. And so there's not a huge amount of research being done in them, although there is the age-old adage, where there's water, there's life.
I was going to say that. there's something.
Yeah, there is something. But, I mean, they are frozen systems, and so people tend not to do a huge amount of work there. And then the other one is because there's so much water and so little of what you're looking at, be it organic matter typically, or what sort of biogeochemists might be interested in, it's analytically challenging for the chemist, you know, to sort of measure things in these low concentrations, or to measure them without having to do some sort of pre-concentration step or pre-isolation step, where you might actually change what you're looking at. And the techniques are coming online now to allow us to do this. And so, if you like, we're sort of going past that threshold where we can finally understand what's in these systems, where it's coming from, and how they work.
Yeah, and it's interesting because glaciers and ice sheets, the second largest reservoir of water on the planet, and yet, just like the ocean, which is the largest, there's so much we don't know about the ocean, and that holds true here as well.
Yeah, and I'd make the case that, I mean, I think that, so glaciers and ice sheets cover about 10% of the Earth, but we really don't know much about them. But glacier biogeochemistry really should be a priority, because the glacial environments are among the most sensitive to climate warming and industrial forcing. I mean, how much longer are they going to be around, say, mountain glaciers in Gulf of Alaska or the Himalayas for us to actually study? And so we really are running out of time in some ways to understand these systems.
Now, your research is also giving, I said, your team, because you have a lot of different expertise, shall we say, on that team. The research is also giving us some idea of how the ocean may have changed over the past centuries.
That's one of the really interesting things that I think came out of this research. So the deposited organic matter appears highly biologically labile, and so it represents this energy subsidy to any waters receiving it. If this is a depositional flux and is ubiquitous across the globe, then, if you like, the surface biogeochemical cycles of today, including in the ocean, are universally post-industrial in a way we do not fully appreciate. And so this material that we're seeing deposited on glacial surfaces is also likely representing a source of material to the ocean that could be subsidizing the food web. And this would be obviously very difficult to detect in terrestrial, or certainly warmer terrestrial ecosystems, because in these more vibrant systems, the deposited organic matter is likely rapidly metabolized. And so it becomes lost in the general milieu of life. Mm. Whereas in frigid glaciers, any input stands out, making them the ideal sort of sentinel ecosystem for the detection and study of human perturbation.
So it's a good place to be. And of course, a warming climate means more ice melting, which means more dissolved organic material flowing into the ocean. So the Gulf of Alaska, maybe along with Greenland and Patagonia, are areas we're seeing the highest levels of glacier ice loss, and likely the areas we should be looking at, like sort of the canary in the coal mine, if you will, as to what's happening with the fisheries in those areas.
Yeah, and I mean, it's kind of a double-edged sword, because in the short term, you're getting this increase in labile organic matter that could support the food web and increase production. But then in the long term, it's going to decline to nothing once the glaciers have gone. And so it's going to be a hard system to certainly predict what's going to happen into the future. And I think a lot of the work, you know, a lot of our work has been focusing on initially sort of trying to get a handle on how this system's going to change in the next 20, 50, and then 100 years. As we see this initial increase in glacial melt and associated flux of organic matter, and then a decline in the long term.
And of course, the question that everybody asks is, you know, when is that point of the glacial melt where there's no return, where the glaciers will, you know, melt to nothing? We don't know the answer to that.
It really depends where you're looking. I mean, the big ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica are going to be around for a long time. The mountain glaciers, their days are becoming numbered. I mean, I've been fortunate enough to start doing some work in Tibet recently, and there it's predicted that about 60% of the current ice is going to vanish by the 2050s, and the vast majority by 2100, if the current rate of thinning continues.
That's shocking. Could happen so quickly. Let's talk about Tibet. You've done all this work in Alaska, and now the question is this happening elsewhere in the world? And you've already started looking at that, and Tibet was your next stop. So tell us about that.
So I was fortunate enough to go to Tibet last August, collect samples, and we're still processing those samples now. We're actually just waiting for the radiocarbon dates to come back, which we'll hopefully get maybe this week. And from the initial data we have, we're finding the same sort of things there. Certainly in terms of the organic matter and how it looks, the composition of the material, we're seeing again this same signature of black carbon in those systems. And so that work will continue hopefully into the coming years, and we're trying to now look at other sites globally.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the other sites is that so far the only one you've actually been to?
Yeah, we've got samples now from a number of other glaciers in the US, and they show the same as what we found in Alaska, so down in the lower 48. We're also hopefully getting samples that have come back from Antarctica. Just coming back from the summer down there.
That would be interesting, yeah, to see what that result was. Was there some work done in Russia?
Yeah, there's been a little bit of work done on the ice cores in Russia. And they found, that's where they sort of did the ice coring. Where they found this step with the Industrial Revolution away from the signature that we find and that they found in those systems.
So the folks who do that research deeper in the ice and then comparing with the research that you guys are doing more on the surface of the ice, this maybe tells a bigger story, right? I mean, each piece is important to the other.
Yeah, I think if we want to prove that this is coming from an industrial source, if you like, the ice coring is important because you should be able to go back to 150, 160 years ago, and you should see a step to where there is a different source of organic matter, if you like, a non-human source prior to the Industrial Revolution. And then the second part of it is looking at glaciers around the globe to see if this process is truly global. And then also there will be hotspots for deposition. I mean, we know that the Tibetan Plateau is a hotspot for anthropogenic deposition. I mean, it's adjacent to major areas of pollution.
Well, that's what I was going to say. What makes it a hotspot? So the hotspots would be the places that are closer to that industry.
Yeah, just predominantly, yes.
Yeah. We're talking with Robert Spencer, assistant scientist at the Woods Hole Research Center. He is studying the black soot, the black carbon in glaciers. How do you determine the source of the material?
So really, we've used a three-pronged approach to determining the source. The radiocarbon dating to get at the bulk age of the material. And so that's shown as a range from, I think the total range we've seen now in all samples is about 2,500 years to almost 8,000 years before present. We've used a number of biomarkers for specific traces of compounds of life. Lignin, which I mentioned earlier, is the marker for, say, higher vascular plants. And so the presence or absence of these can tell you where this material is coming from. And then a lot of it's been this use of ultra-high resolution mass spectrometry, this molecular fingerprinting of the material. And there where you are finding specific traces for things like the condensed aromatics, which are, as I mentioned before, only formed through the heating of organic matter. And so that shows the presence of combustion sources.
So I would imagine now you're taking these samples in these places and then bringing them back to go to various labs for the carbon dating, which is the same process they do with the when they're working with sediment on the land, right?
Yeah, it's been one of the really exciting things, I think, as a scientist on this project, that there's a large group of us working together involving colleagues from a number of institutes and universities and government labs. And that's really been the sort of the key to getting the broad sampling across the US, looking at different glaciers, has been done with colleagues at the US Geological Survey, myself and a colleague at the Skidaway Institute of Oceanography, and colleagues at the University of Southeast Alaska and Yale University as well, sort of been all coming together to do the different, if you like, bringing our different skills to the table to try and find the source of this material.
Kind of like a detective job, isn't it? It's like, why this, and let's prove it this way,
It has been joked at times that it's like CSI organics, that we're trying to find out this material and where it's coming from.
That's funny. So this team of researchers, then, you all bring different expertise to the table, is what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of that's different analytical chemistry techniques that we're bringing to the table.
Mm-hmm. And so what's next, and what are you working on next? I know you're waiting for the results for the Tibet, so where do you go next?
Yeah, I'm going to Germany in a few weeks, so I'm working with colleagues over there. That's where we use the ultra-high resolution mass spec. It's actually not an uncommon instrument, but it's uncommon to use in environmental sciences, and there's only a small number of them in the world, if you like, that are dedicated towards environmental applications. And so we work with a colleague there in Germany. And so I head over there in 3 weeks, and we'll be running the rest of the samples that I brought back from China and Tibet.
So when you're taking these samples, again, just like, I guess, any other scientific experiment, you have this process. You have to be really careful about how they're packed and, what labeled and all of that, because you're not doing it right there on the site. You're bringing it across the world.
Yeah, and that was one of the nice things about working in the Gulf of Alaska. One of the glaciers we work on, my colleague who works at the University of Alaska Southeast can basically see it from his back office window.
Wow.
And we have fantastic helicopter support from one of the local companies that takes tourists up onto the ice field. They let us use their helicopter for free. And, the locals there are very interested in what we're doing and the ramifications for what we're finding. And so they've been very supportive, and it's a logistically accessible site. The work in Tibet was much more challenging.
Yeah.
I was there on my own, which means that you're fully responsible for everything. You're working in remote locations at 20,000 plus feet. And so that was interesting at times. Mm-hmm. And bringing things out of Tibet was also not the most straightforward thing.
I was going to say, that was going to be my question too. When you're working in other countries where the rules can be a little bit different, did that create a challenge for you? I mean, did you have any problems?
My Chinese colleagues were very good at doing paperwork, and they made sure everything was in order and everything was in place, and I had no challenges from the permit side of things. But I mean, as a going in and out of Lhasa, flying in and out was interesting with coolers full of ice and water samples and the rest of it.
Yeah, like, what have you got there? Yeah. So, when you're going into a country like Tibet and you're going to go into some other areas, the government wants to know what you're doing. That government wants to know why are you doing this, and what are you taking, and what is it for?
Yeah. And I was fortunate enough. So I'm working with colleagues in southern China, and they put everything in place for me to go. And then they arranged a colleague who was working at the Chinese Academy of Science in Lhasa. He met me at the airport, and basically they were fantastic and gave me access to their laboratory space there, organized transport for me for where I wanted to go, and sort of supported the logistics side of things when I was there.
That's great. So now the technology seems to be changing on every level. So do you see something? Are there things on the horizon that are going to make your research easier? I mean, you're talking about this stuff in Germany that you're going to be going to use. Who knows what's going to be around in a year or two or 5 years from now?
Yeah, I mean, I think for a lot of what we're doing, with the tools we have at hand now, we're happy for the next few years. We've got what we need to do to answer the questions that we've set. And the big question is always funding.
Yeah, that was my next question, because I don't think a lot of people the people who are living near the glaciers are very interested in what's happening because they can see the impact. But for those of us living far away from glaciers, it isn't something you think about. Like I was mentioning, the glaciers and ice sheet's second largest reservoir of water on the planet. I don't think that's something we think about day to day. Is having public support for your research critical to the funding?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, without public support for scientific research, it's almost impossible, I'd say. And that's why I was funded by the Chinese to go to China and do that work, because they are concerned, if you like, about what's happening to the glaciers, the future of these systems. I mean, you hear it thrown out there sometimes that the glaciers are the water towers of Asia. Mm. They capture water in the monsoon precipitation and store it and then release it in the drier years. And there's a number of serious potential ramifications for that region if that changes and how that changes.
Right. So that would explain why you had so much cooperation, because for them, unlike Alaska, where there's still a lot of water, this could be a serious problem in that area.
Yeah, I mean, increased glacial melting in that region is a serious issue. I mean, increased melt leads to a greater risk of flooding in the short term, and then no glacial melt will in the near future causes rivers to dry up, and so you're into water insecurity. The Tibetan Plateau is the source of a number of huge major rivers on a global scale, Yangtze, Mekong, and they reach numerous countries, right down to India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Nepal, Cambodia, Laos, out into Vietnam. And so if the upstream countries hoard this remaining water, those downstream are going to have a severe water crisis, and more importantly, it could lead to regional insecurity. Declining glacial meltwater has serious implications for hydropower generation in the region as well, and so it can push countries away from potential renewable energy sources. And then on the sort of local scale, lakes swollen at the moment by glacial meltwaters can often burst, and we saw evidence there of they can devastate villages, destroy the farmland, which is normally close to the lakes and the rivers and stuff, and communication links in these sort of very remote, inaccessible places if it takes out the roads and the bridges into these systems. And then one thing that, and this is truly global, people don't tend to think about too much, but pollutants such as DDT have often been banned many years ago, but they've been locked away in these glaciers and deposited in the snow.
And so scary.
As that melts, they're now being reintroduced back into contemporary cycles.
Wow, that's a scary thought. Yeah, it's again. And how do you stop the? You know, how do you stop the melting? You know, that's another big question we have to figure out, right?
Yep.
Robert Spencer, assistant scientist at the Woods Hole Research Center. Thanks so much for being with us, and good luck with your research.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening. Point airs weekdays at 9:30 a.m. and 7:30 p.m. We're also on Facebook at The Point, WCAI. The Point is produced by Mindy Todd, production assistance from Dan Tridle and Jenny Junker, theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.